Hey, everybody, welcome back to another edition, another episode of the Journal Podcast. This is Kevin Rose. Thanks for joining me. We have a great guest for today's show, but before we get into that, I want to back up and tell you a little bit about the Journal. The Journal is my monthly newsletter. It goes out once a month to, right around 60,000 or so people. You can subscribe at www.thejournal.email. Sign up there and you'll make sure to get the newsletter every month. I don't spam you. I don't send a bunch of extra crap to your inbox. I value your inbox and your time, and so I just send one email a month. The email, the tagline for the email is called A Newsletter for the Curious. And that's what I like to do here on the podcast. I like to have someone on that is just an expert in their field that can talk about something that we typically don't run into in everyday life. So I've had some interesting scientists on the show, entrepreneurs, and in this case, the host of another podcast that I absolutely love called Smart Drug Smarts. My guest today is Jesse Lawler. Jesse is the host and is a body hacker, kind of a brain hacker, if you will. So he's a programmer by training, but has stumbled into this field where he has found a whole slew of other like-minded folks that come on his podcast and talk about certain compounds, certain supplements that you can take to really enhance your performance and enhance your brain. So he has had a whole slew of different guests on his show talking about everything from microdosing LSD to different types of meditation and fasting. He's done crazy long 7-day just water-only fasts. Anyway, he's got a whole breadth of experience that we can dip into and learn from. So we're going to get into some really interesting things. We're, of course, going to talk about smart drugs and things and compounds that you can take to enhance your focus and just get more work done, which I'm into. We're also going to talk about some of the work done around microdosing LSD and mushrooms. This is a really hot topic in Silicon Valley right now. A lot of entrepreneurs are doing these kind of little tiny microdoses to enhance their creativity. So a lot of interesting stuff there. And then one thing that I really liked at the kind of towards the middle of the show, we start talking about something called holotropic breath work, which is the state of consciousness that you can put yourself in just through breathing. A lot of people report kind of out of body experiences. So it's really powerful stuff that is done with, along with music and drums. And it's kind of crazy, a little bit woo woo, but it's definitely worth considering trying some of the stuff out. Anyway, we're all over the place and all over the map. It's kind of fun like that. We dive into a bunch of different topics. I did have some audio issues up front for the first few minutes. We then stopped down and started recording manually, so the audio and quality does a big jump up after the first few minutes. So just stick with it, and I promise you a whole roller coaster of different topics and fun things to think about. So without further ado, this is Jesse Lawler, and enjoy the show. So Jesse, thanks for joining me on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I got to tell you, I am a big fan of your podcast. I think it was probably, I would say, Reddit nootropics topic that I found out about it. You have a lot of fans over there as well.
Yeah. I guess that's probably one of the communities that thread and also Longevity, where people are talking about nootropics more than any place else online. So we get bandied about there sometimes.
I got to get your take on this right off the bat. Nootropics or nootropics? I've heard it like both ways.
Oh my God. I say nootropics, but that's just because that's what it looks like when written. The actual, it's made from a couple of Greek words, and the Greek pronunciation of the root word, which is N-O-O-S, is actually pronounced like nuos or something like that, which nobody in the world says it that way. So I don't really think there is a proper pronunciation.
Gotcha. So for people that are new to this world, I'm sure there's a lot of people that listen to my podcast and follow my newsletter that are like, Kevin, who is this guy? Why is he on your show? Talk a little bit about, you know, what this whole community is about, because it is a relatively small community. On Reddit, there's 75,000 people following the topic. But I know that these are really kind of hardcore, what I'd call more or less body hackers, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like body hacking from the neck up, because it's definitely sort of a subset of the overall biohacking community. And, you know, the things you can do to help your body are generally going to be helpful for your brain and vice versa. I mean, there isn't so much of a mind-body divide as we oftentimes are sort of, you know, taught to think in you know, Western culture. So yeah, I'd look at brain hacking as sort of an offshoot of the larger biohacking community. But a lot of what applies to general biohacking is also going to be brain helpful as well.
Gotcha. And how did you get started?
So by profession, by trade, I'm actually a software developer. And there's probably a giant overlap between the people that are currently turned on to nootropics being a thing and software development in general and, you know, Silicon Valley and, you know, all the stuff that you're a part of. It was probably about 10 years ago that I remember I was looking at like a Maxim magazine and saw some little sidebar article about some drug that was taken by some software developers and made them program better. And I was just like, what the hell is this? Because, you know, my only, knowledge of drugs at the time was things that generally make you, you know, dumber or funnier or whatever, but not necessarily something that you're going to take to make you want to, you know, concentrate more. So I was curious about that. And what they wound up actually talking about was a drug called modafinil. They were talking about the trade name Provigil in that original article that I saw. But that spurred my curiosity to do a little bit of research and dig into this. And, you know, it was sort of one of these dodgy things that it was supposed to be a prescription drug, but you could buy it through these Canadian pharmacies that would sell it to you without you actually having a prescription. I was like, wow, is this actually going to work? And so, my curiosity was piqued, and I wound up making a very furtive order, a couple of days later. And lo and behold, like a week later, I got, a jar of pills in the mail, and that sort of started me down the road. And it was probably like 7 years after that I actually got curious enough about it that I started calling up people, medical doctors and researchers and things like that, and recording the conversations, and my podcast was born. For a long time, I was just sort of a casual user, but it's gotten quite a bit more serious in the last couple of years.
Yeah, so you mentioned programming, and I've certainly, I guess that's kind of why I was turned on to this. I think as we get older, I'm approaching 40, certain things, like you'd love to have more energy in the afternoons, more focus, attention. I think that there's a laundry list of things that people are attracted to here, and it seems to, at least on the subreddit, there are just so many different compounds out there, and a lot of them, are legal to buy. You don't need a prescription. Some of them are coming out of Russia. Can you talk about, what do you cover on your podcast as far as the various types of compounds? Are there certain ones that you recommend? I guess a good place to start might be on the energy side of things. Like what are the common things that people, when they come to your podcast or when you're getting into supplements for energy, what are they taking?
Yeah, a lot of the people that I think when they first get turned on to nootropics, and I would consider myself among this group, the first thing that you kind of hear about are the ones that can help with focus or mental energy. And it kind of like looking for something the next step beyond caffeine. Caffeine's something that almost everybody in the world is familiar with. It definitely is a cognitive enhancer, but also has sort of the known downsides of it, can make you jittery if you drink too much and things like that. So, the next level that people are often looking for is, can I have something that will make me more alert and focused and sort of, like aggressively tearing into my work, but not have jitters, not have, anxiety, and not have to get up and go pee as much. And so, that gets you into, compounds that are generally going to be looking for things that would be giving you more free-floating acetylcholine or dopamine. Those are the two neurotransmitters that acetylcholine is sort of a general excitatory neurotransmitter. It makes your brain have more likely to do whatever it is you're trying to do. And dopamine is a motivational neurotransmitter. And there's quite a few things, I guess, I wouldn't consider these nootropics under the sort of the dictionary definition that we'll probably go into later, but definitely on the cognitive enhancement spectrum, we should talk about Adderall and Ritalin, both of which are prescription drugs for ADHD and are pretty well known and are oftentimes used or misused depending on whether you've got a prescription or not for cognitive enhancement purposes, even for people that don't have a ADHD diagnosis. Sort of moving down from there, there's a lot of other chemicals that are probably have less side effects, less addictive potential, that are also going to give you more dopamine, more acetylcholine. And, oftentimes that'll again have this sort of feeling of increasing your focus, increasing your oomph to, do whatever is in front of you.
Do you yourself take these prescription drugs, or is it other supplements that you look at more like the kind of?
I've interviewed people on the show about a whole lot of stuff that I've never taken myself. And that, honestly, that's one of the things that I enjoy getting out of the show is kind of using this as a experimental laboratory as I talk to the experts on these compounds to decide, hey, is this something I want to try personally or not? Adderall, I have not tried, and I probably won't, despite being curious about it, just because it's something that we get talked about a lot. I've taken Ritalin a couple of times. A friend of mine does have a prescription. He just gave me two of them, and I took it to see how it went. I'm not sure that it was something I would ever really go back to, although I definitely did feel the effects of it. I mean, it's a strong drug, no question. But yeah, those two particular ones, I do not take. I haven't taken on any sort of regular basis. Modafinil and its sister compound, armodafinil, both of those are, again, prescription drugs that I've gotten without prescription, which really isn't that difficult, and have taken on and off for a number of years. It's not something I take either of those on a daily basis, but, you know, probably on a weekly basis, there will be some, like, for example, I just took a long plane flight and definitely took some armodafinil to help me stabilize in the new time zone, make it easy to, you know, stay up until the proper bedtime now. And they can really come in handy for things like that. But I think for long-term use, I try to stay away from anything that's going to mess with my sleep cycles, because, you know, you wind up paying the piper at some point.
Yeah, that's my feelings as well. And, you know, I see a lot of these prescription drugs and people talk about them on various forums, and a lot of, it seems like a lot of college kids are using them to kind of cram for tests and things like that. And I tend to, at least when I experiment in this genre, lean on things that are a little more mild, but still give you some effects. So have you ever experimented with, like, say, L-theanine with caffeine?
Yeah. So L-theanine, as you know, is the naturally occurring compound in green tea. It's what makes green tea, despite the fact that it's a caffeinated drink, also kind of, you know, chill you out, calm you down. And caffeine plus L-theanine is a real nice combination stack. And oftentimes when you see those two packaged together in pill form, one of the nice things about getting it in pill form versus just drinking a couple of cups of green tea is they've actually done studies to try to find out what the optimal mix between those two compounds is. And it's something like 2-to-1 in favor of caffeine if you drink it in green tea format, but the opposite ratio of about 2-to-1 in favor of L-theanine is actually sort of what's best for getting your brain in that energized and yet calm state.
It's a really funky feeling. Like I've done straight L-theanine with a cup of coffee in the morning, and you can buy L-theanine on, you know, on Amazon. And right. I did like droppers of it under the tongue, and, you know, you drink some caffeine and normally I get that really jittery kind of feeling, you know, when you do too much caffeine. Mm-hmm. And this just seems to kind of smooth it out, puts me in a little bit more relaxed state, and I can jam through, you know, tasks that I would normally be a little bit just, you know, too many emails or things I'm anxious around, just kind of like gets me through that type of stuff.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a bit of sort of the Dumbo's magic feather for those of us that are into nootropics. Like, I know that if I do this compound, it's going to make me feel a certain way, which makes it easier to get through this type of work.
Right.
And in a way that sort of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy after a while. If you listen to a certain type of music every time you do a certain type of work, eventually that type of music makes you want to feel like doing that thing. But these can really be pretty effective strategies, I feel like, building up some of these, you know, rituals around the type of work you need to do repeatedly.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything else in that general genre? So out of the prescription drugs world, but compounds that, say, you could pick up on Amazon, like, have you experimented with GABA at all or anything?
For energy stuff, I mean, a lot of the compounds that have choline in the name,
right,
like acetylcholine is probably a big one. As a general rule, almost anything that you see, like alpha GPC or acetylcholine, it's also called CDP choline, right. Same thing.
That's all a compound that's found in eggs, correct?
Yeah. Choline is basically, it's available in our diet, but most people do not get enough of it. So sort of topping off your supply with exogenous supplements can be a way to sort of bring your brain up to having as much, you know, ready to circulate acetylcholine as you might ideally want, you know, on a busy or active day.
And what have you found when you talk to people that supplement with, you know, one type or another type of choline? Or did they just talk about the improved just general cognitive function, or is it focus? Is it, what is it that, what boost do you see when you get enough of this stuff?
Yes. Choline in general, it generally is energy and focus. You know, it's funny because the terminology that we have around this is very vague. Like what one person might describe as focus, somebody else might describe as creativity. And even when the scientists are doing studies, like, scientists generally delineate what they're studying very, very carefully. But one scientist's definition of the type of focus he's studying in one study might not be the same as the next guy's study.
Sure.
And so it can be kind of hard to make some of these general rules. And that's one of the things that's actually nice when you see scientists that are doing the same damn type of study, like, you know, rats doing these particular swimming mazes, and the next scientist is doing the same swimming maze test with rats. And you can say, okay, these guys are actually testing this, the same end result with these different compounds. Sure. But you know, it really is tough to generalize based on anecdotal reports of, well, you know, I read this Reddit thread and you know, Susie so-and-so said that, you know, this compound does this for me, and thinking that it's going to do the same thing for you. Almost everybody's going to be familiar with caffeine. And for the vast majority of us, it's a stimulant. It's something that makes us more, you know, amped up and can, you know, even be jittery at the far end of the caffeine spectrum. But I've spoken with people, and it's a not insignificant amount of the population, maybe like, you know, 3-5% that has exactly the opposite result from caffeine. They take it and it's depressive. It makes them sleepy. It makes them feel pretty much the, you know, exact reverse of what most of us feel. And so it just seems like for most cognitive affecting compounds, it's difficult to make generalizations. I mean, you can make generalizations, but that doesn't mean that it's going to affect any given person that same way.
Yeah, it seems that I've seen recognize this or seen this firsthand, and then I've had a friend of mine who was a little hungover. He took 2 5-hour energy drinks, and then he passed out and slept for like 4 hours.
Oh no!
Everyone watching him do it was like, this guy's going to be wired, and he took that and just immediately passed out, and it was just it put him right to bed. And I was like, I don't know how that's even possible. It's like 10 wow, hours of energy. Yeah. Like, so I can see how that would be the case. And then also that kind of echoes what you hear actually in the Reddit forums. A lot of people talk about how someone will say, this was the most amazing thing. It saved my life. It, you know, lifted all of my brain fog. And other people say it had zero effect on me. So I definitely see what you're saying.
It's funny. It's like, obviously we've only had scientists for the last, you know, 100, 200 years really. But I think how much easier it would have been to do sociological studies, you know, like 10,000 years ago, where, you know, everybody's who at least would be in a certain like living area is like eating essentially the same diet, probably has very similar like wake sleep schedule. You know, they have the same genetic background because they're all living in a certain area. And, you know, nowadays we have people of, you know, all different right. races and ancestries eating food from all over the world. You know, just all sorts of different exercise regimens. Like this person, you know, works outdoors. This person sits in a chair all day. And we try to make these, you know, sweeping studies that are like, okay, population wise, this is what this drug is going to do. And man, that's hard to tell.
Yeah. We've introduced like, you know, thousands of new variables that weren't there before, just several hundred years ago.
Yeah.
Which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, it really is. And one of the other, you know, big issues now is they're starting to realize that so many of the studies that have been done on the different effects of things medically have generally been done on white males. And that can be a giant problem if you're not white, or if you're not a woman, or rather if you are a woman. And, you know, sometimes there's just some giant holes in the studies based on that, you know, what seems like it should be a forehead slappingly obvious mistake.
Right. So you basically, your general advice must just be to try it and see how it does it for yourself, basically.
Yeah. I mean, I think the general advice is to see what the broad spectrum studies say as far as safety and things like that. I mean, you don't want to take anything that's going to be too dangerous or past your danger threshold. But if something seems like it's going to be beneficial for most people, give it a try, but recognize that it might not be the best thing for you. And also, there's so many different compounds that have been shown to have one benefit or another that, you know, you probably don't want to have 100 pills in your medicine cabinet and try to take all of those every day. So hopefully you right. can find the one or two that are most effective for you personally and zero in on those.
Cool. Yeah. Well, I'd love to tell you about a couple that I've tried. I'm curious to get your take on them. You know, I got into ketosis here a while back. And I was really hardcore about it, and pricking my finger, you know, 3 times a day,
yeah,
eating just gobs of fat. And, you know, a couple things that I noticed had an impact on me were, you know, what has been called kind of the bulletproof coffee, but I did it with my own stuff where I was taking actually powdered MCT oil, which I found was a little bit easier on the stomach, with some grass-fed butter and some coffee in the morning. And that just, one, it really increased my ketones, and it just gave me a level of kind of clarity and focus in my early morning work that I hadn't had before. Have you tried MCT oil or powder?
Yeah, I have tried MCT oil. I haven't stuck with ketosis for more than a couple of months at a time, mainly just because I love fruit too damn much. But mm-hmm. I've become a big fan of intermittent fasting. And generally, I won't have my first like meal other than fats until about 3 or 4 in the afternoon. So yeah, I'm pretty on board with like the low level of ketosis that you can get through the early day just by, you know, not having any food since the night before.
How often are you fasting?
For intermittent fasting, it's like a daily thing. But for longer,
you're doing it every single day?
I probably intermittent fast like 6 days out of a given week. I mean, if you know, I have a brunch invitation or something like that, I'll occasionally, you know, do that. If you're going off intermittent fasting for a day, doesn't really hurt anything, but I definitely do it the majority of my life.
And do you stick to 13, 16 hours? Like what do you kind of aim for there?
I have a 7 hour eating window. So I'll typically go like, again, I'll start 3 or 4 in the afternoon and just kind of like, you know, start the stopwatch then. So, you know, 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night, I'll, you know, wolf down a little bit of dessert and then that's it until the next day.
Yeah. Would love your take on that. Why is it that you personally fast? I've done this kind of on and off, but, what's the research and the reasons behind, you doing the intermittent fasting?
Well, I guess that we can talk about both intermittent fasting and the longer term fasting, which is are kind of different beasts and different reasons for doing them. For the intermittent fasting, I mean, I've just found, regardless of how healthy my diet is, and I do keep a pretty healthy diet, I still feel like my brain is clearer when I just don't have food recently in my belly, and that's almost regardless of what the food is. So being able to get through the majority of my day's work before there's any real digestion going on, I just find makes me a little bit more, you know, cognizant, aware, whatever. And then, you know, part of that, and there's actually, I can dig out this study for you, but they've shown that even with intermittent fasting on a window like we're talking about of, you know, 14 to 16 to 18 hours, there are changes in the levels of both dopamine and serotonin, which are neurotransmitters that are generally good things to have in the brain. As we mentioned, dopamine is a real like motivational neurotransmitter, and serotonin generally, you know, has to do with mood effects and, you know, makes it easier to be in a good mood, essentially, if you've got enough, you know, serotonin available to your brain. So, I suspect that probably part of the benefits that I feel from being in that, you know, low-level ketosis throughout the early part of my day might be a result of just those slight neurotransmitter changes.
Yeah, I've been doing the intermittent fasting for a while. I'm kind of aiming for 16 fasted hours per night. And I have also noticed a big boost, and I'm a huge fan. Have you read any of the research by, it's Dr. Sachin Panda over at the Salk Institute?
I don't think so, no.
Oh, he's got some fascinating data around fasting and circadian rhythms.
Yeah.
And what it does to various blood markers. And it's just a really positive thing that he's finding there. And it's specifically time-restricted feeding that is tied to our waking hours and daylight hours. Mm-hmm. And that when it starts to get dark, we start to produce more serotonin, and how that's bad for our body. And we should be in a fasted state when that starts to happen and not have our largest meal at the end of the day, when we really don't need those calories for anything. We're about to go to sleep, and yet we have these massive meals before we go to bed.
Right, right.
So some really, really interesting research coming out of there. I'll put a couple links in the show notes, but Dr. Rhonda Patrick did 2 recent interviews around time-restricted eating that are just really fascinating that you should check out.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting because, like, I think a lot about the evolutionary psychology of what would we have done, you know, pre-society, and it's kind of seems like eating a big meal towards the end of the day, it's hard to think that wouldn't have been kind of like what we would have done as cave people or whatever. Come back together with the tribe, eat the food, and go to bed fairly early after the sun went down. But it's interesting if what we might have been doing naturally isn't necessarily what's best for us physiologically.
Yeah, I wonder if I was thinking the same way, because I always tend to think, you know, what did the caveman ancestors do? And it's a fun way to kind of reconsider anything that you take as a daily habit. And, you know, I think about the data that's coming out of this shows that we're best able to cope with food and the calories coming in when we need them, which is during the day, right? So mm-hmm. You would imagine that potentially, I wonder if the meals, the larger meals, weren't eaten for breakfast when you need that all day energy to go out and hunt and do various activities. I don't know. It's just a fun things to think about.
One more thing to check when we get the time machine built.
Exactly. So one question I had about you that is a big topic in Silicon Valley, and I'm sure you've seen all of this being, you know, there's been articles on Wired and all over the place, but it seems that a hot topic, at least in the Bay Area, is the idea of microdosing various compounds.
Yeah.
And that can be for creativity. It can be for, you know, to gain insights into certain things. But, you know, this idea of using kind of psilocybin, mushrooms, and microdosing those, or microdosing even LSD. Like, what is your whole take on this? Is this something that you've had conversations with other people about, or you've personally experimented with?
Yeah, I actually spoke with Dr. James Fadiman. He's a longtime sort of psychedelics guru, wrote a book called The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. And at this point, I think his main focus is sort of being a public cheerleader for the idea of microdosing. And it seems like there's not that much bad to be said about it. I don't know if there's any downsides per se. I mean, there's no real physiological dangers, even at, you know, recreational or beyond recreational dose levels for things like psilocybin and LSD. You know, obviously you can scare the bejesus out of yourself on drugs like that, but you're not necessarily going to do anything to hurt yourself. You know, there are rare examples of psychotic breaks and things like that, but these tend to be people that, have a history of mental illness in their family and things like that. For most people, those drugs are pretty safe. So as far as microdosing goes, there doesn't seem to be any physiological downside. The question is, what sort of a mental uptick are you getting from it? Now, with LSD, I've heard that the typical amounts that people take when they're microdosing are between about 10 and 30 micrograms, which is, you know, ballpark, you know, maybe, you know, 10 to, you know, I guess a normal dose is 100 micrograms, maybe 150 micrograms. So, you know, a small percentage of what would normally be, you know, breaking the psychedelic threshold and getting you into a real drug trip. I think that by like the 30 to 40 microgram range, people are starting to get some real perceptual effects. Again, this is going to vary from person to person because different people sort of, you know, break through that threshold at different levels. But the idea with microdosing isn't necessarily to be, you know, tripping out. It's to be, you know, going through your work day in a slightly altered state, you know, maybe be in a better mood because of it, maybe be in a more, you know, relaxed or creative headspace because of it.
Yeah, this is the crazy thing that people are taking is, and they're just going to work.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
It's like, it's not about just, you know, having fun with your buddies on the weekend. This is really about actually performing.
Well, I mean, the thing is, though, I don't think that there's a heck of a lot of difference between a 10 microgram microdose and drinking, you know, two Starbucks ventis and then going to work. I mean, both of those are things that affect your brain. Right. They definitely do have, you know, effects that you're going to be able to feel or notice. Like, I mean, you presumably if you can't notice the effect, you wouldn't be doing it to some extent. But you're not, you know, tripping balls, as it were.
Right, right.
I think one thing that's worth mentioning about microdosing, this is true of I think all the psychedelic compounds, definitely all the ones that are serotonin based, as far as what they're doing with your brain. But it's not something where you can do the same amount day after day after day and expect the same result. If you take, you know, a like amount of psilocybin or LSD on two consecutive days, you're going to have like a, you know, 60-70% drop off in the effectiveness on the second day. You know, I've heard people, you know, seeing some like online reports like, oh, you know, I did, you know, I microdosed for 7 days in a row is like this test, see what it was doing. And like, unless they were ratcheting up the amount they were actually taking day after day after day, which I don't think most of these people are, then really, yeah, the effects after like day two are pretty much pure placebo effect. It's like really you need to give your body some time to sort of bounce back from that. I think realistically, you know, microdosing maybe, you know, twice per week is as much as you're going to get unless you're really ratcheting up the dose to you know, deal with the tolerance.
Yeah. The thing I was always curious about with these microdosing is it just people going out and, you know, having fun with this and, you know, like you said, it is like a couple cups of coffee and that's it? Or are there real kind of creative breakthroughs that are coming out of this? You know, is it something where you're approaching problems in a different way or you're able to shift your kind of headspace to a place that it wouldn't normally go? I guess that's really subjective, but I you know, have you heard anything about any of the results of this?
Well, I know the answer to that is that the studies really haven't been done yet. You know, there's a lot of excitement around this, but they haven't really done the scientific work to see what exactly is going on. We have a lot of anecdotes from people that are positive about it, but you know that's not quite the same as a broad spectrum scientific study. I would suspect. So I'm just going to go full on speculative here. This is just Jesse's best guesses. I think that what people will get out of a microdose is probably going to be significantly different based on whether or not they've done a macrodose. You know, it's because it's kind of like a microdose is probably going to remind you of the headspace that a full psychedelic trip will put you in if you've been on a full psychedelic trip. You know, if you give somebody 10 micrograms or, you know, 20 micrograms of LSD and they've never had LSD, you know, I think they might just think, oh, I'm in kind of a good mood today and think nothing more of it. I suspect that having had previous psychedelic experience at a full, you know, well beyond the psychedelic threshold dose gives you something to kind of like a mental reference point. And you know, to the extent that microdosing might have some placebo effects built into it, it kind of gives your placebo something to aim for. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess there can be no question from anybody that has done a psychedelic compound that you're going to be more creative on that compound. You're going to come up with a lot more ideas. They might not necessarily be good ideas, but I feel like the number of new weird ideas that you generate per hour of thinking is going to go up by some, you know, significant degree. So the question is, you know, are enough of those ideas good ones that it's worth the trouble? And, you know, of course, whether you enjoy it, that has a lot to do with it too. And then does that ratchet down? If you scale down the dose by 90%, are you still going to be getting, you know, a significant uptick in creativity? I think generally people that have done microdosing feel like the answer is yes, but we don't really have the studies to back that up. It would be awesome if the studies get done. I feel like the sorts of studies that are being done in psychedelics now, it's awesome that we've sort of reached this point where, what's it called, investigational review boards, IRBs, are starting to say, yes, it's okay to do human studies on psychedelics, but most of them seem like they're aimed at helping people that are, you know, cancer patients or people with post-traumatic stress disorder, people with like real big problems.
Which I love that, actually. That was another one that we didn't even touch on, is a lot of these compounds, you know, especially the psilocybin, are being used for, you know, people that have returned from war and are having all these issues, or people with severe anxiety over having terminal cancer. And from what I've heard, they're pretty damn effective at that.
Yeah, you know, I think it's awesome that those studies are being done. I mean, I would love to see a whole lot more psychedelic studies be done, but I think that it's a very strategic move right now on the part of people that are trying to bring psychedelics more mainstream, saying that, you know, nobody's going to say, well, you know, screw this cancer patient, screw this person with post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, we don't need to do this study. It's like, it's much easier to get a study like that approved than just somebody saying, you know what, I want to go to work on some acid and see if it helps. It's like that's a bit more of an ask, right, to try to get that study approved. So I feel like hopefully we'll continue to see real positive results from some of these studies into, you know, psilocybin and depression, or MDMA and post-traumatic stress disorder, things like that. And that'll, you know, continue to kind of swing the hinge open further wide, so we can do some of these other studies for, you know, just, you know, everyday people that maybe don't have some of these extreme problems, but would still be having some gains to be had by access to these drugs.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, this stuff is really early days. Well, it's not early days, but it's early days in the fact that it seems like the floodgates are kind of slowly starting to open again for, yeah, this type of research. So it's really exciting in that regard. You know, I'd love to touch on a couple more things. Meditation. What are your thoughts on it? How often do you do it, if you do? And then I believe you had, didn't you have an episode on holotropic breath work?
Yeah, yeah. Meditation, my thoughts are it's hard, but yeah, you know, the science behind it seems to be, you know, overwhelmingly positive. You know, they've seen a lot of change. I mean, kind of what brought me around to it, despite the fact that I've sort of tried getting myself on the meditation train for a couple of points throughout my life, and it never really stuck.
What did you use? Did you use any apps, or what were you, how did you get started?
Well, the first couple of times I tried was like before iPhones existed. So this was, you know, 20 years ago or whatever. But like I said, it wasn't something that I was able to kind of get myself to stick with. I just wasn't seeing any particular benefits. But, you know, in the past 10 years or so, coincidentally, since apps were invented, you know, they've done a heck of a lot of studies that have really shown, you know, brain changes that are in some cases quite profound and quite lasting, you know, additional, you know, gray matter within the brain for long-term meditators almost everywhere. It's not like localized to a particular area. They do see some significant changes in certain areas, but when somebody's been meditating for a long, long time, it's like the whole brain has, you know, more of what you want it to have. And you see, you know, the brain shrinks as we age. Like once you're, you know, past 25, everybody's brain is slowly shrinking, but the rate of shrinkage in long-term meditators is quite a bit shorter, or rather quite a bit slower than it is in non-meditators. And so when I started reading studies like that, I was like, well, crap, I got to give this another go. So I have been, for about the past year, I've probably been meditating 2 days out of three for about 20 minutes. I'm not as consistent. I don't always do it first thing in the morning, although that's when I prefer to do it. I don't always do what I would consider a very good job, because I find myself thinking about other things in the middle and, you know, have to pull myself back. So yeah, again, it's not something I feel like I'm very good at yet, but I'm really making a good college try at it, because the science does seem so, you know, unequivocal that there's benefits to be had. One of the other really interesting things is that despite the fact they see these benefits to the brain from long, long, long time meditators, the changes can actually start really quickly. They've done some studies that have shown measurable changes in just a couple of weeks from people that are undertaking meditative practices, and not like, you know, sitting on a couch all day meditating, but like doing, you know, 40 minutes a day for a couple of weeks, and they can measure changes in the brain. So that's seems impressive to me.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat as you in that I'd like to do more. I've experimented with a few different varieties of meditation, most recently with the transcendental meditation, which has been interesting. It's more mantra based than kind of mindfulness, which is different, and it puts you in a very rhythmic kind of trance like state, mm-hmm. which has been fun and weird, but also fun. So it's kind of hard to explain. I don't know that it's enjoyable, but it's really interesting when they have you do the practice, they make sure that you do not set a timer. So most meditation, you have, you know, 20, 30 minute timer, your timer goes off, you stand up, you go about your business. With this style of meditation, because you are doing the mantra over and over again, you're supposed to come out on your own. So you kind of leave your timer going and set it in front of you on the floor.
Yeah.
And then you glance down at it when you slowly come out. And they told me, like, don't come out of it with a timer. You'll get headaches. You'll be in a different weird space. I to be honest, I thought that was just kind of bullshit. but until I was at the office and it was in the afternoon, I was like, you know, I just got to get in a meditation session. I'm going to go in the closet. So I sneak away into the closet. I shut the door. And I'm in the closet that nobody uses, right? But sure enough, I'm like 15 minutes into meditation and somebody barges in because they wanted to take a phone call in there privately, and I'm jolted out of my meditation. And
popular
when I
closet.
Opened my eyes, yeah, seriously, I opened my eyes, it's like everything is kind of wavy in that it's just kind of like, I don't know if you ever have woken up in the middle of the night like to, you know, drink some water or whatever it may be, and you're kind of in a you know, 50% asleep kind of state,
right.
But you know where the water is and you grab it and you chug it and then you're right back to sleep. That was the same feeling that I had where everything was kind of wavy and I was in a trance-like state, and I was out of it for probably 20 minutes after that. Like I got up and kind of found my way out of the closet, but it was really not the right way to come out. Anyway,
interesting.
Fascinating how it put me that deep that quickly, whereas I hadn't had that experience with the kind of the general just follow your breath style of meditation, which is the most common form that you see, you know, preached about in these various apps.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you're in like delta wave brain state, you know, when you take
exactly.
a nap and you wake up, same thing, you can get it from napping, like you wake up at the wrong time or somebody wakes you up and you're like, oh my God, and like it takes you half an hour before your brain's all the way back awake. It's interesting that, the mantra-based meditation did that for you.
Yeah, and you know what I was going to tell you? One of the other things that has put me into that state is I did the Wim Hof method. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that.
Yeah.
You know Wim?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not personally, yes. But yeah, I know him by reputation.
Yeah, so he has the whole ice training, mm-hmm. and he also has breathing exercises that go along with that. But his breathing exercises are, they kind of put you in a hyperventilation type state,
yeah.
That you do this breath work, and it really puts you into a crazy kind of another world. And I found it really easy to complete these pretty intense breathing exercises, get myself into like a really high state. It's like, you know, I feel like, you know, it's like I'm at a concert and I'd smoked a fat joint. Cause like you're just,
yeah,
you're like, you're kind of out of it. And then, go right into meditation. So, you know, I was curious, can you tell us a little bit about another type of breath work, which is like that, am I pronouncing it right? Is it the holotropic?
Holotropic. That is, and actually, yeah. That one I actually am confident in the pronunciation of much more than okay. nootropic.
Yeah.
But yeah. So holotropic breathwork, I mean, I feel like I probably shouldn't be the poster boy for talking about this because I've only done it a handful of times and I'm
sure. That's more than I have. So I'm curious on your experiences here.
Yeah, but the gist is, I mean, it sort of is controlled hyperventilation. Generally, it is done to music. I think sort of the, according to Hoyle, proper version of doing it is you do it with a guide, maybe, you know, sitting in a circle with a bunch of people, listening to some, like, you know, tribal music with a beat and stuff like that.
It's like ayahuasca without the ayahuasca.
Yeah, it's like ayahuasca. That's a perfect, yes. And like that kind of always makes me a little bit suspicious when there's like sort of a ritual induction method. For anything, I'm like, if this really works, why do I need the ritual? Like, shouldn't right. the compound be doing it itself?
I kind of like that though. There's some charm to that, you know. There's a little voodoo in there, a little woo woo, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I know. Just but part of me, I mean, I'm always curious about it, but I'm just like, what would the pure version of this right. be? And that's the reason.
And you don't want to wake up with like a tattoo on your forehead and having just joined right. some new cult. Like,
yeah, where the hell is my kidney?
Right, exactly.
But Yeah. So holotropic breathwork is, I found it when I've done it that it is, I don't like the process of getting into it. It feels like I've never drowned, obviously, but it kind of weirdly feels like you're drowning when you're forcing your body to breathe at this super hyper unnatural pace.
Walk us through the very beginning. So you sit down, you're in this circle. Everyone's holding hands. What comes next?
I've never done the circle version.
Oh, you haven't done the circle. Okay.
I interviewed a guy who leads these circle things on the podcast, and so I sort of learned what the deal was, and then I've just done it myself a couple of times at home, you know, locked in a room so my girlfriend wouldn't find me and make fun of me and stuff like that. But yeah, basically, you know, I put together a little playlist on my computer that had, you know, some stuff with real driving beats at the beginning and then would kind of like, you know, ease me out, some stuff that didn't have English language lyrics, so I wouldn't be thinking about the words, but just, you know, like...
Did he recommend this playlist to you, or was this something you just developed yourself?
No, actually, yeah, he did. He sent me some recommended songs, and I just downloaded them off iTunes and stuff that. I can share that with you and, you know, put those up. I don't think the songs really matter. I don't think he thinks the songs really matter. But sort of the idea is to get something that you can match your breathing to the drum beats just to kind of keep it easy and to have a pretty, you know, aggressive, high tempo, you know, drum beats, at least leading into this. And so you're doing full exhales, full inhales, much faster than you need to. I mean, it really is, you know, you're gulping oxygen.
Right. So this is the same as the Wim Hof method, by the way, so far. It's we do 30, like, rather fast, but deep, full inhale exhales.
Yeah. So this goes on. I mean, like, I had my playlist be for about a half an hour. And one thing that I really noticed from it was, like, my ability to estimate how much time had gone by was way off. Like, I basically, my 30 minutes ended and I thought I was probably like, you know, 10 or 15 minutes in the first time because they were all songs that I was unfamiliar with. It's like, I hadn't listened to these songs to kind of get the gist of them. So when one ended and the next started, I didn't know if that was a 7 minute song or a 2 minute song.
Right.
But yeah, it was,
is that it though? Is there any holding your breath or anything? Or is it just the rapid breathing?
It's just kind of that. And you know, weird things start happening. Like physically, some people would get real like muscle and joint aches. Like your body just kind of feels like almost Charlie horse feelings for some people. What I kind of sensed from it was like, I just needed to start kind of like moving my body, like keep shaking my arms and legs out. So you know, I was basically like lying on my bed, you know, doing this, you know, rapid breathing with earphones on, and you know, it was dark in the room. I had, you know, like a sleeping mask on, so I didn't get any light. But like I was kind of, you know, doing the boogaloo, like waving my arms and legs, so I wasn't getting this cramp feeling. So I probably looked like a bug, like a beetle that's been flipped on its back and is waving its arms and legs around trying to right itself. So yeah, not the most dignified looking thing to do, but kind of once you get into it, it was actually really interesting. Like I guess, you know, the sort of time can. The opposite of dilation, time constriction, time contraction was the main thing that I noticed psychologically.
How did you feel when you kind of came out of it? Were you in just a weird space or?
Yeah, it was a weird, like, well, the thing I was kind of hoping would happen, because it does for some people, is like a full on, like DMT style, like you leave your body and you're somewhere else and you're having visual hallucinations and you know, real weird stuff that you would typically associate with like a you know, psychedelic drug trip.
Right.
That didn't happen for me. It, like I definitely, I felt very strange, and not necessarily in a bad way. And what was interesting is like when these sort of the physical sensations started, the difficulty forcing myself to breathe at that rate more or less ended, and I was kind of in a rhythm where it got comfortable. And that was weird. There was definitely like a breaking through moment where all of a sudden it was kind of like switching gears between a car. You know, you can grind the gears as you move from one gear to the next, but once you get in the next gear, you're fine. And it was kind of like, that's what it felt like my breathing did. After a while, my body's like, okay, we're breathing at this speed now. Cool, no problem. But yeah, as far as then coming out of it, it was a few, like I basically, the first time I did it, I like turned on the microphone and just started recording like my thoughts, like, okay, I'm coming out of this. I was just breathing weird. And I put part of that in a podcast episode, so you can kind of hear me sounding a little bit screwed up. Yeah, I would liken it, I guess, to kind of waking from a dream where you're a little bit slower than normal. You have these memories that are kind of quickly fading, that like those wispy memories, like if you write it down real fast, you can remember it, but it's kind of, it's getting out of there fast. You know, some people have had like, you know, spiritual breakthroughs and things like that from holotropic breath work.
That's what I've heard. That's why I was excited to try it. I want to try this because I've heard people get more or less, like you said, the DMT type effect without having to do a hit of DMT.
Right. Yeah. I didn't have anything quite that profound happen to me, but again, I'm perfectly willing to acknowledge I might have not been doing it in the correct way. And I'm hoping to get together with, his name is Dr. Jim Ironman. He's up in your area, actually up in the Bay Area, who was the expert that I spoke with on that. He leads, sessions of holotropic breath work. So I would like to kind of do it in a formal, like appropriate setting, just to make sure that I'm doing it the way that it should be done. But I think it's definitely worth investigating.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting that you know, I guess you had one of your podcast guests on that was talking about DMT and how it's actually produced in the lungs.
Yeah. So that was Dr. Rick Strassman, who is kind of, you know, the man for DMT, at least as far as the study of it in a scientific format. So DMT is produced endogenously. DMT is dimethyltryptamine, and it is, I think, pretty much the reigning heavyweight champion of psychedelic compounds known to man. It is, it's a longer topic than we probably want to talk about in a quick little segment here. But what's really interesting about it is that it is the only psychedelic substance that is produced within the human body. It's produced normally in very vanishingly small amounts, but it's actually in almost every living thing, plants, animals, fungus, the whole thing. They do not yet know what its purpose is within the human body. There is speculation that it might have something to do with dream initiation. There's, Rick Strassman thinks it might be something like a, what did he call it? He called it a consciousness thermostat, which I thought was a great term. Somebody should turn that into a band name.
Yeah.
The probably single most interesting thing about DMT from a, wow, isn't that weird perspective, is that most things that enter the brain that cross the blood-brain barrier are diffusing across that membrane. That basically they're kind of small enough to fit through the pores and the brain doesn't obstruct them from getting in. So if there's more of a substance outside the brain than there is inside, then guess what? It's going to slowly diffuse into the brain. DMT is different in that there are actually receptors on the surface of the brain that look for DMT molecules, and when they find them, they expend energy to pull them into the brain. So it's kind of they work upstream, like, hey, we see DMT out there, let's get it in here. Wow. And that's amazing that a substance that we don't even know why it's in the body to begin with, the brain is willing to burn glucose just to bring it on the inside.
Wow.
And that's crazy. It happens to be the most powerful psychedelic known.
Right. That's insane. Yeah, I've certainly been really interested in reading, and your podcast was a great one. I've heard a couple others out there about people and their experiences with DMT. It's a little too, I think that, you know, this idea of smoking DMT is just sounds nuts to me. Like, I don't want
I'm with you.
I don't want to like take a pipe and take a hit of something and then it's like go into twilight zone, you know, for a half hour. The ayahuasca stuff sounds interesting in that obviously that's another way to take DMT. I don't know, maybe one day in Peru or something.
Yeah, I mean, I'm super curious about ayahuasca. I'm sure I'll do it at some point. Like, my hesitation is purely like the ritualized aspect of it. Like, I something about me just like cringes at the idea that in order to try out this compound, I've kind of got to, you know, listen to this certain music and sit with this group of people and be told, like, you know, have it called like Mother Ayahuasca and kind of like buy into this whole symbology of it. It's like, I just kind of want to try the stuff.
Well, see, I like that. And the reason I like that is I feel that if I'm going to do it, I would rather have it done the way it's been done for thousands of years with trusted guides rather than just do it like super, you know, white boy style in my apartment in New York or something.
You know? Yeah, I mean, I hear you. But I mean, just to play devil's advocate, I mean, there are plenty of things that are traditional that are still really bad, really stupid ideas. I mean, you know, like, you say, you know, beating your kids is traditional. It's like it's happened throughout human history. Most people have done it.
No doubt. No doubt.
Yeah, no, I ayahuasca, DMT, both of them are things that I'm super curious about, haven't attempted yet, but are probably on the menu eventually.
Yeah. Yeah. Same here. One thing I will tell you real quick, since we were talking about the holotropic breath work. So the Wim Hof method, in case you ever want to try it, and be very careful here because many people that have done the Wim Hof method, the breathing have passed out doing it. And, you know, obviously you want to be, you know, in a safe place, laying down somewhere in case that happens to you. I know one, person in particular, a friend of mine that passed out, in a swimming pool while trying to do it and almost drowned. So it's one of those, if you're going to try it, you know, be in bed, you know, with pillows around you. But Wim's method is essentially, it's 30 breaths. So you start and you go like, like that would be two, right? So really deep, somewhat fast breaths. You do 30 in a row. And when you hit 30, you breathe all the way out, okay? And when you breathe all the way out, then you hold it. So you stop and you don't do anything. You hold it for as long as you can. Now, when you've got all that oxygen going into your brain, and I've clipped on my finger an oxygen meter. So I typically, everyone's a little bit different, but I typically run at around 98% oxygen level in my blood. And what happened is when I did those 30 breaths, is I immediately shot up to 100. So my blood was at least, you know, that's what the little Amazon.com device that I got says.
Yeah.
And then you hold it, and I can hold my breath obviously a lot longer because I have so much oxygen in my blood. So I was holding my breath for about a minute and a half to 2 minutes. And then what you do is when you can no longer take it and you have to take that breath, you take the breath in and then you hold it again. And this time you only have to hold it for like 15, 20 seconds. So you're sitting there holding no breath, and then you inhale and then hold it. And immediately this rush of just like warmth and zen passes over your body.
Wow.
And it lasts for about 45 seconds. And then you go immediately into the next round. So then you start breathing again. Boom, boom, boom. 30 more breaths. Then you do it again. So it's not the same experience every round. Every round it intensifies. So you do this for four rounds. And by the time you get to the fourth round, I'm telling you, it is like you swear that you just took some kind of crazy drug because you're floating in the clouds. You feel amazing. Wim has you after round four jump up and start doing push-ups, and you immediately can do about 30 to 40% more push-ups than you could at baseline. So what you do is you go and you measure your push-ups, you know, that morning, just do as many as you can until you fall on the ground. And then later that night, do the four sets of breath and then go straight into push-ups, and you'll do 30 to 40% more push-ups. It's insane. And you get all these tinglies and kind of like bolts of energy going down your arms. It's really crazy. It's really crazy.
So question, like, I mean, now that you've done this, I mean, is this something you do every day? Is this part of your standard routine now?
You know, I don't know if it's good for you. That's my only hesitation because you're obviously not giving your brain any oxygen. One thing I have really enjoyed is I said after I stopped doing the Wim method, which I did for 10 weeks, which was amazing. And it was amazing for so many other reasons, mostly around the fact that really ice cold water releases a ton of norepinephrine and you feel just phenomenal for a couple days after you do these really intense, you know, 15 minute ice baths, which I was just filling. My wife is like, what are you doing? I was taking bags of ice and putting it into the bathtub.
Yeah.
So anyway, that I still continue to do. I do ice training all the time. I love it. That won't change. This was a great kind of lead in to meditation. Like, I think there is no better way to get in the zone then doing this breath work and then going straight into just say 20, 30 minutes of meditation. It really is a game changer. Anyway, fun stuff.
Yeah, I feel like I've got to drop this one just because it has to do with water and breathing and ideas and all that stuff. I'm forgetting the guy's name now, but he's a really famous Japanese inventor. And he's got like more patents to his name than anybody in the history of patent offices. He's invented like 3,000 things and like stuff we use every day. He invented like the CD, like the you know, optical laser discs, and invented karaoke. He's just invented a ton of different things.
Wow.
And his method for coming up with ideas, as crazy as it sounds, is he goes underwater and sits at the bottom of a swimming pool until he feels like he is just about to die. And he says, like, when you're about 30 seconds from death, according to him, that's when you get the really good ideas. And wow. He spends like an hour a day or so underwater. And he's just, you know, he's kind of like this, you know, old tubby looking Japanese guy. It's not like he's a, you know, like a professional swimmer or anything. He just sits at the bottom of a pool and waits for ideas to come. But the guy has invented everything. That's a really weird story.
You got to get that guy on the show.
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, I'm actually in the process. I just found out about him fairly recently, but yeah, he's somebody I want to reach out to because it's such a weird story. And the thing is, it's like there are tons of examples of people that do amazing things and completely misunderstand what it is that allows them to do the amazing things. So just because this guy mm-hmm. is like a creative genius, I'm not necessarily buying into the fact that sitting at the bottom of a pool is what has allowed him to become a creative genius. But on the other hand, it's like, you got to give him a day at court. Yeah. Like I really want to hear his explanation for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if that you feel this way, but the reason I'm so excited about all these different various compounds is like, I feel like there's, you know, we have like, it's like gold rush days. Like, you know, we have all the tools, like there's gold somewhere in the hills. We just have to like really hunt for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's somewhere, and I can sense that it's close. And in little experiments like this Wim Hof method, that I would have never tried that before, except this year, you know, one of my New Year's resolutions was to just try some crazy body hacking things. I did it, and I think I'm better off for it, you know? And I think that there's a lot of little things like that, that is just as humans, if we would just give ourselves a chance and try various things, we might discover something amazing.
I am such a believer in that idea. I just think that trying things, even if they don't work, even if they're kind of stupid, even if you wish, you know, I probably hurt myself rather than help myself on that one. Just kind of, you know, being aware that there's a lot of stuff out there to try and that some of it can be really helpful.
Yeah.
Is great for people to be aware of.
I mean, I did SoulCycle one time, which is ridiculous. It's like riding bikes to the beat of like rave music. It was horrible, but I tried it. Yeah. You know, it's like everybody was doing it. It's like this thing that took off in LA and New York and all over the place. And
yeah,
it was the worst thing I ever did, but it was, you know, at least I can check that box and say I tried it. So,
right. Yeah. I mean, we were talking a little bit about, fasting earlier. And I mean, I guess that's kind of worth mentioning for like the long-term fasting is there's a bunch of interesting physiological reasons to do it. But I think probably the thing that I got out of it the most was just sort of an experiment in willpower, seeing, you know, can I make myself not eat anything for a week? And that was, it was so far beyond the pale from what I'd ever done previously. It was just really cool to know that, hey, oh, yeah, my willpower will allow me to push myself to this weird new level. And I wonder what the actual, you know, what would be a willpower barrier for me?
Yeah, so you do with your readers, you do a week, one week a year. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, I think I'm actually going to probably start doing it once quarterly now. I had a really good experience this second time. I just did it for the second year in a row. I did it in 2015. Now in 2016, we did it probably about 3 months ago, and it was definitely easier the second time. And what I felt like the perceptual effects from it in the second half, this second time, were pretty interesting for me. I really felt like, I went 7 days with nothing but water. And for me in days 5 and 7, both of those days, I felt really mentally sharp and clear, almost like a light serotonin high, where colors seemed a bit sharper. My long distance vision seemed a bit better than it normally is. Which again, it's like, how do you measure that? I didn't know to expect it. So I didn't do any, you know, before and after tests with eye charts or anything like that, but it was definitely something I noticed.
And what were your ketone levels during that time?
By the end of it, it gets up to about, you know, 6.5 for me.
Wow. That's pretty high.
Oh yeah. I mean, cause you're starving to death. It's like, you know, a nutritional ketosis is defined as anything above 1.0 millimoles per liter, but yeah, you break that within, you know, 36 hours normally of going into full starvation. I mean, they don't call it starving for nothing.
Yeah. Are you going to do a 3-day, 5-day, 7-day? What's the next one for you?
From what I've heard, I'm not sure this is a standard practice, but like I think like a lot of SEALs, people in the special forces and stuff like that, will do 1 day a week, 3 days a month, and 7 days a year of full, acaloric fasting, no calories during that time. With their goal for doing it is because that way, if they're on a mission off to do whatever, and they aren't able to get food, it won't be a big distraction for them. It's like their body knows how to handle it. They know that they're not going to freak out. I kind of like that as a just sort of the cyclicality of it.
Yeah. Well, and of course, if you get called to any special missions, you're set,
Right. Could happen.
You never know when that could happen.
You never know, man. I'm ready when they need me. But I think I might start doing it quarterly now. I haven't done it a second time this year. I'll definitely let my audience know in case people want to get in on it again. But we had probably about 30 people that we did a little online community and stuff around it last time. So we'd have other people to commiserate with about the food that we wished we were eating, but we weren't. But it was a cool experience.
Yeah, well, that would be fun. If you want to combine forces and I can invite my newsletter folks in, we could do a combined fast at some point.
That would be fantastic.
Cool. So one last question before I let you go. Thanks for all your time, by the way. I know this is kind of run a little long.
No worries.
I really am curious, given that you are kind of the guy when it comes to this stuff and obviously have a really popular podcast about it. What does your medicine cabinet look like? What do you eat? What do you supplement? Give me a rundown of that.
Yeah, I managed to sort of consolidate a lot of things when we put together the two stacks that we actually have for sale now. So things that were in my medicine cabinet in individual bottles now got kind of thrown into these capsules, which was nice. But I guess kind of like the starting things that I would recommend to almost everybody is fish oil. Omega-3 fatty acids is something that most people are not getting enough of, or rather they're getting too many omega-6s, not enough omega-3s, and so kind of fixing that ratio is pretty important. There's a lot of things to be said for getting extra omega-3s in your diet. It's also a little bit of like a prophylactic in case you get a concussion in the future or any sort of traumatic brain injury. Having some the physical building blocks of the brain ready and on standby within your system seem to be able to make people bounce back from any sort of brain insult or injury better. Another one is vitamin D3, something that most people are somewhat deficient in, not getting enough of in their diet or getting out in the sunlight, things like that. So that's a pretty easy one to recommend. Recently, I've been taking something called Bacopa Moneri, which is it's an herb from India and I think other parts of Asia as well. But it's really got pretty significant benefits for memory. It can be helpful for old people, helpful for staving off dementia and Alzheimer's and things like that.
How do you spell that?
It's Bacopa is the, if you just look up Bacopa, you'll find it. The second word is just like the scientific name of the plant. But, did an interesting episode on that a couple of months ago that was like, okay, this is something I really should start taking. So, some of these things aren't super exciting. You don't take them and feel it. You can't tell that I had this pill this day. But, the science seems to be there to say that, yeah, this probably really is doing something beneficial over the long term. Yeah, so I'm willing to err on the side of optimism for things like that as long as there's no significant downside. Then for the more exciting ones, I've always been a fan of aniracetam. That's one of the racetam compounds, and we built our cognitive stack Nexus around that. So Nexus it's got aniracetam, it's got one of the choline groups that we talked about earlier, CDP choline. It's got something called phosphatidylserine, which again is naturally occurring within the body and brain, but you can sort of soup up your normally endogenous amount for that. And then a compound called pycnogenol, which is made from a pine bark in the south of France, which sounds very exotic. That's something that I take almost every day, probably 4 or 5 days a week. And then quite a bit of mitochondrial stuff. Take something called sulbuthiamine, which is a synthetic vitamin B1. It's like two vitamin B1 molecules bonded onto one another, but that way it crosses the blood-brain barrier easier. The brain likes things that are, lipophilic versus hydrophilic. Yeah, PQQ is something that, it's also in our stack mitogen, but it encourages your body to manufacture more mitochondria. Mitochondria are kind of the little energy apparatuses within each of our cells that make something called ATP. ATP is kind of like the universal energy molecule within, I think, all life forms, actually. And so because the brain is a very energy hungry organ, having more mitochondria available to kind of these little internal powerhouses is helpful for your brain as well as everything else. Those are kind of the things I take day in and day out. I mean, there are definitely other things that rotate in. I try not to take the same damn thing every single day, partially because I just like having some days feel different than the others. When I'm doing a big computer programming jag and I want to, you know, be sitting and, you know, staring at a screen for 8 hours, it's like I definitely like modafinil or armodafinil for that. If I'm doing something more creative, I really like, you know, aniracetam or the aniracetam stack that I've got, Nexus. One of the things, I think the reason that I interpret that as a creativity drug is because aniracetam has been shown to be beneficial to short-term memory. So basically the number of ideas that you can hold in your mind at one time are increased. And creativity is essentially being able to look for the connections between various ideas. So if you've got sort of more ideas there on your, you know, spread out on your mental table, you have the ability to look for, you know, more potential combinations of those ideas that might be useful insights.
Yeah, I've never told you this, but I actually purchased some Nexus and I've tried it and I thought it was great.
All right, thanks, man.
Yeah, I bought some here a few months ago, and
good deal.
I actually spread it around. One of my coworkers sits across from me. I talked him into trying some as well. So
fantastic.
We like cheersed our little capsules together and then tried them at the same time.
Dude, man, take a photo when you do stuff like that.
Yeah, I should. Thank you so much for sharing all this stuff. It's all been really fascinating. I've loved listening to your podcast and actually got turned on to a bunch of different stuff. I really enjoyed your episode on mushrooms, and I've been taking lion's mane because of it.
Yeah, that was an interesting one, wasn't it? Thank
really
you, by the way. Yeah, no, I really, really appreciate it.
Cool. So if folks want to follow you, you know, check out your podcast, your newsletter, what were the best places for that?
SmartDrugSmarts.com is the website, and that's also, minus the .com, that's the name of the podcast. I do have a Twitter account. SmartDrugSmarts has a Twitter account. I've got a personal one. You know, if you want, I can set up, I'll set up SmartDrugSmarts.com/KevinRose, and that way, if you have like a couple of favorite episodes that you want to highlight and say, you know, Kevin particularly liked these ones, we can put up those links for your fans.
Oh, absolutely. I've got four or five that I just thought were phenomenal.
Cool. Well, yeah, if you want to just send me that list, I'll set up a little landing page for your people.
Perfect. And I'll include that in the newsletter. So that's great.
Excelente.
All right. Well, thanks, Jesse. Really appreciate your time and hope to have you back on soon.
Yeah, man. Absolutely. Really appreciate it. And I'll be in touch real quick here.
All right. Take care. All right. That'll do it for this episode. I wanted to thank you for listening. Just on a little note here, this is just done by myself. So this is a one-man show here. So it's slowly getting better with time. I'm going to work on some new intro music here for the next episode. So hopefully we'll have a new little theme song. I hope to have some more segments and potentially some guests on the show to kind of rant and talk about the various different things that we include in the monthly newsletter. So I'm going to be changing up the format over the next few months. Please do let me know. Respond to the newsletter. I do get those responses if you just reply back to the newsletter once you receive it. And tell me what you're liking, what you don't like, especially around this podcast. If you want to see some more Q&A or whatever it may be, do let me know. And I also want to thank the folks that have gone out there and given me a 5-star review on iTunes. That helps out a lot in the ranking of the podcast and gets us a little bit more visibility. One in particular from AM Amp Once is his name, gives me 5 stars and says, "I've been a fan of Kevin Rose since the Dignation days. Thank you for listening way back then. And I've always liked one thing about him is his focus and attention. He pretty much gives anything that he becomes interested in. I know this is going to be a great podcast, awesome episode." So thank you so much for the review. And like I said, please let me know how we can improve things. I think that obviously it's great to have the old Dignation fans. In fact, I'd love to get Alex on one of these shows. That'd be a lot of fun. So expect a lot more kind of random craziness for this podcast going forward. Always interesting guests, and thanks for listening. See you soon.